Today, when Mark Zuckerberg sat down to type out his New Year's resolutions nearly a year ago, did he know just how bad the next 12 months would be? Plus, in opinion, lessons in the aftermath of the wildfire that laid waste to the town of Paradise, California. Almost a third of the world's population are on Facebook. 1.3 billion people use it every day, including me. It's a way to stay in touch with friends, organise events and keep up with the news. Every year, Mark Zuckerberg, the company founder, uses Facebook to post his New Year's resolutions.
Mark Zuckerberg's New Year's resolutions started fun, I think it's fair to say. They started as a little PR thing for this boy executive. He has, in the past, pledged to do things like learn Mandarin. Only eat things he killed himself, which involved him also learning how to kill things with a bow and arrow, which is, to be fair, quite impressive, actually.
This year, he went for a different approach.
This most recent resolution at the beginning of 2018 was to fix Facebook.
No exception. He says he is going to take this year to make Facebook better for all of us.
I don't think he's done very well.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, 2018, a terrible year for Facebook.
What came out over the course of 2017 was, firstly, the extent of the Russian information operation targeted against America, and separately, the use of Facebook by domestic extremists, essentially.
The Guardian's UK tech editor, Alex Hearn, has been following Facebook's journey.
Over the course of 2017, all of that became largely inarguable. You could not look at Facebook and not say that part of the reason why American politics in 2018 was so different from American politics in 2008 was due to the rise of this one site.
It's always difficult to keep your New Year's resolutions going for long. How long did Mark Zuckerberg get through 2018 before things started to go a little off track?
3 months. And it was us who pushed it off track.
Facebook will hold a company-wide meeting today about the unfolding scandal with a political data firm, Cambridge Analytica.
Claims that information from millions of Facebook users may have been used by a data company during the 2016 American presidential election.
All right, joining me right now, Carol Cadwalader. In a nutshell, what went on here?
Facebook found out in December 2015, when The Guardian published the first article on this, that the privacy of millions of their users had been compromised and that that information had ended up in the hands of Cambridge Analytica.
So in March, The Observer published the first tranche of the Cambridge Analytica files, revealing that a information operation, essentially, run by a UK elections consultancy called Cambridge Analytica, had used Facebook data from upwards of 50 million users that it had obtained without their permission. And it had, with that data, certainly tried to get Ted Cruz elected as the Republican candidate, probably tried to get Donald Trump elected as president, and possibly tried to influence Brexit. Broadly, it was collected under the guise of academic research. That is what most users were told when they installed this app, Your Digital Life, created by a Cambridge University academic, Alexander Kogan. They authorized this app to collect information not only about them, but about their friends as well. That app did it, and then the information was handed off to Cambridge Analytica. A week after the news broke, Mark Zuckerberg posted an explanation and an apology on his Facebook page, saying that it was a breach of trust between Facebook and the people who share their data with us, and he promised to fix it.
And before we knew it, Mark Zuckerberg had to testify in front of both Congress and the EU Parliament.
Yeah, he had to testify in front of both houses of Congress. It was a busy day for him and me.
We have 44 members between our two committees. That may not seem like a large group by Facebook standards, but it is significant here for a hearing in the United States Senate.
Mark in front of Congress was quite impressive in terms of his ability to bat off questions time and again. Each representative got 7 minutes to ask him questions and then it moved on. So every representative wanted to be the one who asked the critical question.
Do you think that you have an ethical obligation to notify 87 million Facebook users?
Do you have the right to put my data, a name on my data, and share it with somebody?
I do not believe we have the right to do that.
He looked like an automaton, batting down questions.
Can you make changes to reduce the amount of
data? Are you willing to change your business model in the interest of protecting individual privacy?
Congresswoman, I'm not sure what that means.
I'm promising to follow up with information that in many cases never came.
Senator, yes, we will commit to that. I think that that's an important conversation to have.
And all of that set off a cascade of follow-up stories that's plagued Facebook all year. Let's fast forward to September. What else went wrong this year?
In September, regulators around the world started to come down hard on the company. In the UK, the Information Commissioner's Office announced an intention to fine Facebook £500,000.
The regulator has been investigating how the details of tens of millions of users ended up in the hands of the political consultancy Cambridge Analytica, and concerns have been raised about
a drop in the ocean for Facebook, the amount of money it makes in a couple of days, but also the maximum amount the ICO could at that time legally fine. They threw the book at the company.
It sends a very strong message to Facebook and to other online platforms about what is expected of them, and that the regulator will step in with sanctions.
Facebook also revealed that it had allowed a breach of 50 million user accounts to happen through a coding error. It looks like that was common or garden spammers stealing the login accounts. It wasn't, as best we know, foreign military trying to steal good American users' details, but not good anyway.
After attacks by Rohingya gunmen in Rakhine State a year ago, government forces began a crackdown against the Rohingya. The UN says reports of up to 10,000 Rohingya killed are a conservative estimate.
In the same month, the UN issued its report on ethnic cleansing in Myanmar.
The report from UN investigators includes accounts of numerous atrocities, including gang rape, enslavement, and the killing of children.
Said the role of social media is significant. Facebook has been a useful instrument for those seeking to spread hate in a context where, for most users, Facebook is the internet.
Now, this is an independent report commissioned by Facebook on the role it played in violence in Myanmar last year. The report concludes Facebook has become a means for those seeking to spread hate and cause harm. We also had a report a little while back from the UN, which has already detailed how Facebook was used to spread anti-Rohingya messages.
And why did Facebook let that happen? Why hasn't trying to limit hate speech been something that its executives have cared about?
Facebook is an American company, and they take a broad view of what hate speech is and how it should be dealt with. In Myanmar, though, the broader problem was that they expanded into this country without anyone who spoke the language there. They didn't even have internal tools that were capable of displaying the local character set. So if you were trying to read a post in Burmese on Facebook's tools, you just got a series of boxes. If someone flagged hate speech to Facebook's moderators, particularly in the early days, the moderators couldn't read it.
It sounds like we're already at a crisis year now. We've
exactly.
had this situation in March where we find out that a data firm, Cambridge Analytica, which has since been closed down, was essentially getting access to all this Facebook data. You've got literally data being hacked in this way. Mm-hmm. You've got, scandal around hate speech in a country like Myanmar. And then in November, the New York Times published its big investigation into Russian meddling in the run-up to the 2016 election.
The New York Times story was called Delay, Deny, and Deflect: How Facebook's Leaders Fought Through Crisis.
What did they find?
So the investigation was into Facebook's response to this Russian misinformation campaign from 2017. And it found that they just continually followed this pattern of delaying their responses, of denying allegations until they decided it was in their interest to accept them, and of deflecting any criticism of them elsewhere.
The security team that had found the information had taken it up the chain to their people. And Sheryl Sandberg does sit at the top of that chain, though it's unclear at this point how much she was told about.
So, amongst other things, we learned that, for instance, Facebook removed attribution to Russia from its first report into the misinformation campaigns. They acknowledged that there was this misinformation campaign running, but they just didn't say who did it. And it looks like that was a deliberate attempt to reduce the pushback from the Republican Party, who Facebook feared would accuse them of going to bat for the Democrats if they said the truth, which was that there was a Republican misinformation campaign, which was overwhelmingly in Donald Trump's favor. It also brought out one very particular nugget of bad news for Facebook, which was highlighting a link to an American political consultancy called Definers.
Today's business climate calls for a vigilant intelligence operation to stay on top. Definers Public Affairs has developed the systems to handle this complex and evolving world.
Definers does the dark arts of political lobbying. It smears opponents. It even runs an in-house fake news factory where it will write up stories that it wants to spread, put them on a website which looks like a news website.
Our full-service campaign-style media war room continuously monitors a full range of media platforms.
The specific example that really set the cat among the pigeons was that one of the things Definers had done was spread allegations that George Soros had been directly funding Facebook's opponents.
One of those targeted was the billionaire philanthropist George Soros after he described the social media network as a menace to society.
This in an atmosphere where George Soros is regularly used as an anti-Semitic dog whistle. The subtext was Jews are trying to crush Facebook. This was not a third-party agency running wild. This was them doing what they'd been hired to do, which was attack Facebook's opponents.
Do you think it's feasible that they would have been unaware of the anti-Semitic link of this type of activity?
I think it's hard if you are aware of the state of American politics in 2018, or frankly, British politics in 2018, to be unaware of the anti-Semitic overtones of blaming a Soros-funded conspiracy for anything, really.
And we're not done there. There's another scandal beyond that. End of last month, to do with the emails obtained by an app developer called 643 in the course of a lawsuit. Remind us, why did 643 sue Facebook?
I mean, the short answer is because they're kind of sleazy. 643 developed an app called Pikini, with a P.
Pikini?
Pikini.
Right.
That automatically searched through your Facebook friends to find pictures of them in bikinis. It did this back in 2014. When Facebook's website allowed app developers to do that sort of thing with friends' data, the very same loophole that allowed Cambridge Analytica to take all of this information out and use it to run election campaigns worldwide.
And that loophole was closed?
That loophole was closed. Facebook closed it for good in 2015, and so Pikini sued.
You have to go back 4 years when a small app company called 643 sued Facebook, saying that it was favoring some app developers over another, saying that it was being inauthentic in how it communicated privacy controls and what information it collected. So
correctly saying that closing the loophole had killed their business. They're not the most sympathetic protagonist in this.
No, I'd love to be, spend a day in the kind of press office of Pikini.
Right.
And see how they decided to go ahead with this.
What did happen is they got a huge amount of emails handed over from Facebook to them as part of the discovery process, the pre-trial process. That was sealed by a California court. It can't legally be published in America.
Now a select committee of MPs in Britain has acquired those documents ahead of a hearing on Tuesday, which representatives of seven international parliaments will attend.
What happened then was Damien Collins, the chair of the parliamentary committee that oversees the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sports, threatened the CEO of 643 with contempt of parliament. So the CEO handed over these emails. Damien Collins obtained them, read them, and then in early December, published large tracts of them.
There were thousands of emails, but only a fraction were handed over, right?
some 250 pages overall, a lot of emails. Those don't make Facebook look very good, I think it's fair to say.
These are really serious and important issues. I think Facebook has been slow to realise how seriously we take them, and other parliaments around the world do as well, and we're prepared to use all the powers that we have to try and get to the truth. Facebook say the complaint...
Amongst them are a series of discussions from 2012, when Facebook was first considering closing down this loophole that let developers take data off the site. And what those discussions show is that privacy was not by any means foremost in Facebook's mind. Mark Zuckerberg himself personally discusses, well, maybe we should allow developers to continue taking data if they pay us. You know, all of these things really make it hard for Facebook to still claim with a straight face that when they closed this loophole, it was only to protect the privacy of their users.
And one of the emails Zuckerberg wrote, that may be good for the world, but it's not good for us.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, if you listen to Facebook's public campaigning, Facebook is good for the world. What Facebook does is connect people, and connecting people is good. Therefore, Facebook is good. What these emails show is that, you know, at least sometimes that's not how the company views itself. On the one hand, yeah, that's just business, right? But that's kind of what this whole thing is about. Facebook is just a business. They're out to make a lot of money and put a significant chunk of it back in Mark Zuckerberg's pocket. The problem is that it let its PR get away from it. It started believing that it wasn't a business, that it was this wonderful force for good in the world. And so when we start getting evidence like this, that clearly wounds Facebook. These days, there is no question that Facebook will be regulated in Europe, in the UK, in America. Facebook itself will these days say, we want regulation. They know that if they try and push back on any regulation at all, they're just not going to get a say in what eventually comes.
Have you got a Facebook account?
I have a Facebook account. It has zero friends and it follows one other Facebook user, Mark Zuckerberg himself.
What, don't you use Facebook to chat to your mates?
No, I used it a lot at school, a bit at university, and then I left university and I realised that I didn't like it. I didn't like what it did with my time. I didn't like what it did with my friendships. In 2014, I had to make an account again because it turns out that it's quite hard being a tech reporter with no access to Facebook.
So Mark Zuckerberg is an interesting figure. He's quite public. He's done a tour of America. He's given a lot of money to charity. We're reaching the end of 2018 now, so he must be sharpening his pencil for his 2019 New Year's resolutions. What's next for him?
It's hard, isn't it? Because there's not really an easy way. You can't, after promising to fix Facebook, go back and say sort of, I'm going to learn to swim the channel. Like that would just stand odd. But you also haven't fixed Facebook. So committing to do anything other than still try and fix Facebook would seem a bit odd in its own way.
Think same New Year's resolution 2 years in a row.
My guess is you can't delay and you can't deny. You can't delay because it's January 1st. You've got to make it. You can't deny because you can't stand up and say, I fixed Facebook last year. So what you do is you deflect, you turn the attention elsewhere. So my guess is on January 1st, we'll hear something about one of the other companies he owns.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Alex Hearn is The Guardian's UK tech editor. You can read all his reporting at theguardian.com. After the break, we return to the city of Paradise, California, to assess the damage from one of the most devastating wildfires on record. Now, environment reporter Oliver Millman recently travelled to Paradise, California, to see how its residents were coping in the aftermath of the Camp Fire.
Ruth McClarty is a surgeon. She's been a surgeon at the main hospital in Paradise for the last 16 years. And on the day of the fire on the 8th of November, she was in the middle of doing a gallbladder operation, which is a fairly routine operation, but it was complicated by the fact she was told to evacuate right in the middle of it.
And somebody was standing over me and said, Dr. McClarty, we really got to go. And so instead of changing, I grabbed my clothes that I'd worn to work and headed out.
She managed to finish up what she was doing and then flee in her car, much like everybody else in the hospital. She managed to get a little way down the road.
And headed through flames, and then I turned into the heavily wooded area and got trapped there. At first moving through flames, and that was scary, but then actually got stopped. You couldn't go forward, you couldn't go backwards. There were cars burning around, the car on my bumper burned. At one point, there was fire so close to my car, I'm thinking, it's just any second this car's going up in flames. I called my daughter because it looked like I couldn't make it out. And she's like, just drive, Mom, just keep driving. And I said, there's no driving, there's nowhere to go. I was praying and singing. I used to sing to her every night, and so I was kind of singing the same, it's the same songs in the same order every night. I mean, she could predict which was coming next, and I was singing those and praying. And while I was doing that, somebody who had lost their car jumped in my car, not knowing who I was. But as soon as they got in there, she saw me and she said, Dr. McClary, she said, I think we're going to die. And I said, I know. And my daughter heard this.
Luckily, miraculously almost at that moment, a bulldozer appeared and pushed a wrecked vehicle out of the way, and that essentially saved her life. I travelled to Paradise in California in the wake of the deadliest wildfire that the state has ever seen. To date, 85 people have died. There's still a couple of dozen people missing as a result of the fire. It essentially obliterated the town of Paradise, which is a town in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains in California. Many people have described Paradise as looking a little like a war zone, and you can see why that description is so appropriate. Even before you get into the town, there's a military checkpoint into the roads that lead into the town. Only certain people are allowed in, only journalists and emergency workers and elected officials in residence haven't been allowed back to their houses as yet. So even when you approach the town, you can get a sense that something is not quite right, something's very, very amiss. Once you're in the town, the damage is immediately clear. When you look at people's houses, you get to the residential area. It's a town of 27,000 people, but 90% of the houses are gone. They're essentially just clumps of ash and twisted metal sitting in patches on the ground with a few charred trees around them. It's quite a challenging thing to go and see. It's eerily quiet. There's even the birds have left the trees. There's no sounds. I went back with Ruth for the first time to see it.
Yeah, it's just surreal. You don't really know what to think, how to process it. I mean,
and she was quite visibly shaken by the experience.
I knew that there wasn't anything here, but it's just strange. It's just bizarre. This is a garage over here.
It was hard to kind of quite imagine what stood there before. She was looking at what was remained of her. A life in Paradise, and she's not entirely sure whether she'll be able to go back like many people there. You've essentially got a town that's been incinerated, razed to the ground, and surrounding that are camps of people who have had to flee. I went to one camp in the parking lot of a Walmart superstore, and there's about 75 tents still there, rather bedraggled now as it's been raining. Very kind of grim setup, and there were people there who had no idea where they were going to go, and there were people who thought they would never be in this situation. Nowhere is essentially safe from the effects of climate change, and people tend to think of places like Bangladesh or far-off islands in the Pacific Ocean, but it can happen in California, it can happen on the east coast of the US, it could happen, as we saw in Europe with the wildfires in Greece, and people's lives are going to be upended, they're going to be turned upside down due to the warming of the planet. And that's going to be something that's going to affect everybody, wherever they live.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening. Today's producers were Mithili Rao and India Rakerson. Sound design was by Ivan Manley. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. If you enjoyed today's episode of Today in Focus, then please subscribe and leave us a review. See you tomorrow.